I'm Cameron Crowe, and I'm very, very thrilled to be here with these amazing artists. And I just want to share this with you. These are seven signs that you are a serious Neil Young fan. Number one, you already own both of these movies on bootleg VHS and real VHS. Number two, you bought Pono just to get Time Fades Away, finally. Three, you made the journey to Winnipeg to visit Neil's childhood home on 1123 Grosvenor Avenue. And you were told to wait because Bob Dylan got here earlier and refuses to leave Neil's bedroom. Four, you've stolen the street sign saying, "Welcome to Zuma," twice. Five, you went to 10 shows on the Lanois tour, and you're deaf. Six, you bought 10 copies of the autobiography Waging Heavy Peace for Christmas gifts, and though you know Neil wrote the book sober, you kind of wish he'd also written a version stoned so that you could read the stoned version sober and the sober version stoned. Seven, you were at the Kodak Theater at the 35th row, and when Neil started playing Flying on the Ground is Wrong, you turned to your friend and said, "Wow, this is amazing." And Neil stopped playing, turned your way, and said, "I can hear you." Anyway, on that note, I give you the man himself and this wonderful cast and a rare reunion of one of his most personal films, Human Highway. We have Charlotte Stewart, who you know from... Yes. You know her from Little House on the Prairie and Twin Peaks and, of course, Human Highway, and she has a book coming out on June 1st. We have Jerry Casale, wonderful visionary from Devo. From West Side Story, Seven Brides, Twin Peaks as well, and Peyton Place. He was nominated for an Oscar for that, the great Rust Hamblin.
Yeah. Yeah.
And our director, Neil Young. Neil, you're very much of a visual songwriter. And I wondered, is your directing process comparable to songwriting? In other words, when you're songwriting, are you making four-minute films at the time in your mind?
No, I'm not. I'm just singing and making up words. Wow. And, you know, there's pictures, but they're all one thing.
Wow. So coming out of Comes a Time, you began to get back in touch with your filmmaking process, and you started filming the beginning of Human Highway.
Yes.
What was the little creative urge that hit that sent you there?
Well, you know, I always felt like if I did many things at once that I wouldn't get bored. I thought that I saw a lot of people that had been with me for a long time that were just starting to repeat themselves and get bored with what they were doing. So I wanted to distract myself from music so that I wouldn't just only do music. Because I thought if I got away from it, then it's like, how can you miss me if I never go away? Kind of, you know. So that's how I felt with my music. If I had just abused it, stayed with it, that it wouldn't be good.
Wow.
That I had to come back to it, and then it was fresh again.
And as a fan of movies growing up, what were the movies that touched you?
I liked, I used to watch a lot of horror movies and sci-fi movies and Jerry Lewis movies. I really liked Jerry Lewis movies.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, pretty funny. Pretty funny stuff.
Charlotte, you've worked with many incredible directors, many varied directing voices.
Very lucky.
What is it like to be directed by Neil Young?
It was a lot of fun. You know, we improvised a lot of the things that we did, and we'd come in the morning and Neil and Dean Stockwell would run us through the kind of gist of what the story was going to be that day in the diner or, you know, wherever, and then we were free to create our own characters. Everybody kind of came up with their own. Mine was based on Heart of Gold, which I loved, and I thought Charlotte would have a heart of gold. And I think that's what, you know, kind of makes her so sweet.
That's so great. Russ, now I think you would have a meeting with Neil in the mornings and kind of talk about what the organization of the day was going to be.
Usually it was the same conversation. I'd say, what's the plan today? And he'd say, the plan today is no plan.
We were just kidding.
You invited me to the set of Human Highway, which was pretty thrilling. And I remember you had a checkbook around your neck. And I asked somebody, like, why does Neil have a checkbook hanging around his neck? And they said, because Dennis Hopper keeps asking him for money. And he said, what do you think, I have a checkbook hanging around my neck? So you got one. But this was kind of Dennis Hopper's, kind of a lower point in his career. And you were reaching
right
out to him.
Yeah.
And
it was great.
But what was that like, to have like that kind of a creative arsenal and Dennis Hopper in your film?
Well, you know, he is a great artist, and it was just, you know, Dean was really important to us all in bringing everybody together, right. And Dean Stockwell was very important to Human Highway. Yeah. And so we did it together. You know, Dean really, we knew we had to write something down to get, you know, not beforehand, but, you know, sort of sketch it out. And then after we did it, we'd write down what we did and have it done.
And so the script came out exactly what we said.
We
followed the script, and the script followed up.
Exactly.
Jerry, what was, did you ever have a discussion with Neil when you knew you guys were going to film together? Did he ever say, look, my creative process is kind of spontaneous and we're going to do it this way or that way? Or how were you prepared for the filming that happened with you guys?
We were just amazed that Neil liked us. We, you know, when you only know somebody through their work and you guess who they are as a person, you're always wrong. And so when I met Neil, and when we all met Neil, we were at, you know, all of our previous kind of cliched impressions that we might have had were blown out the window. Because this was a guy that, even though he was super successful and we looked up to him, he was still treating things like a do-it-yourself Hollywood outsider, even though he had money. And he was extremely funny, and I would have never figured that out from his songs.
Yeah.
And it was just great, because I think we had about a five-minute discussion about Linear Valley and being nuclear waste workers, and when he told us, well, the world's going to end in this movie, we want it in. It fit the Devo cosmology very well. And we were an art cosmology collaboration group, and Neil was working the same way as a director. He's very collaborative.
Yeah.
So he knew what you were good at doing, and as long as you were going to do what you were good at, he'd let you do it.
That's great. There's some beautiful acoustic performances that you filmed at the boarding house in San Francisco that are sprinkled in the film. I wonder if you've ever thought about releasing just a piece that's just that boarding house concert.
Yeah, we thought about it, but we listened to it on that. I didn't think it was that good. I listened to it, and a couple of the things are good, and they're special for different reasons, and it's good that if you're into that kind of thing, it is chronologically, it really sits in a space, which is right in between. You know, when we were making this Human Highway and Rust Never Sleeps, right around then. So it's a interesting thing for that. But really, when you listen to the actual performances and the tonal quality of what we had, I didn't think it was up to, only for historic reasons would it be good, I think.
Got it. We have a few questions from the audience, but first I want to just ask, the birth of Rust as a concept and the whole idea of everything's getting bigger and you are smaller. How did that kind of...
Well, that happened.
Yeah.
So all I had to do... You know, I felt it. I felt like I wasn't like I used to be. And I got to a certain point where my body deteriorated quite quickly at a young age. And I finally had to get on top of it. And I've been physically training ever since to stay on top of like a post-polio syndrome thing that happened. And so I was kind of rusting and doing that. And also I was getting really small and the world was getting really big. And the bigger I got, the smaller I got. It was weird. The more success I had, the smaller I felt.
Wow.
then the less in control of what I was doing. I felt like expectations were much more of a burden than I ever thought they would be. So, and I really am not. I didn't enjoy that part. So that's why a lot of my MO was to try to tear that down and break it.
Wow. The filming style of Rust is also very dissimilar from other concert films, you know, that are so kind of blocked out and the shots are all the same. You tried different focus ideas and different lenses, and you seem to have had a very strong idea of how to make the Rust experience.
I really wanted to be that you were in it, but you weren't a distraction to it. So you could fly right in and see pretty close enough.
Yeah.
And then... And you could pull back, and you really saw more than you usually would see. There's more size to it. So we were a little aloof. You couldn't get up and see how close, you know, what was going on exactly in my face.
Yeah.
And everything. We used 16 millimeter because we could afford it and because it looked like film and it was cool and it was beautiful. And it didn't look like 35. It just looked right for me, a fuzzy comic book, kind of enough of a... enough unclear information to make it believable that your imagination could start working, you know. So we did that, and we had a great cinematographer, David Myers, and a DP, and then great camera people and operators and crew all through the whole thing. And we had 8 top-notch cameras, all rolling film all over the place, but most of them with long lenses, shooting through atmospheres to get to us. So it had a look to it that was unlike, you know, where you'd see, you know, some dickhead with a camera right in front of you. You're trying to play, you know, it was like Woodstock or something where these guys are crawling all over the stage. It was, I hated that. So I didn't want them to be between us and the audience. That's so funny. I really tried to not know they were there. If I saw a cameraman, I mean, today you see them all over the place and, you know, they're like, snails or something. They're just everywhere. And a lot of them are talented. They're great. But they're everywhere. And there's too many of them, and everything's about what it looks like instead of what it sounds like. So, you know, I'd rather close my eyes and listen to a movie that I could feel and see in my head. And it doesn't have to be presented to me on celluloid or any digital or anything. There's so much of that now I crave to just listen and let my mind go with that.
Wow, well said. In Human Highway, guys, when you first saw the film that you'd been making, it was a couple of years after you'd finished.
Which version?
Exactly. Does Neil call you up and say, "I have a cut to show you," or did he wait till there was a final? Well, how did the journey continue post film?
We actually made the movie. That middle part was the original movie, and then we waited for about a year, and then Neil called up and says, "Well, I've cut the movie down to about 10 minutes. And we're going to shoot a whole new beginning and a whole new end." And that's when we did the crazy, that's the really dorky part.
Yeah, Linear Valley.
I don't know, Jerry. I think you're still filming Human Highway. I think it's still a living thing. You can feel there's more coming.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very Devo in its own way. I mean, and we never saw it until it was premiering in Westwood, like in 1982, though we'd shot our scenes in 1979. So it was a big surprise to find out that we were actually driving that truck for hours from the beginning to the end of that film.
A question submitted by Lori from D.C. In the past few years, Neil, since you turned 65, you have written a memoir, started a music company, cut 3 albums, and embraced environmentalism in a big way. What's fueling this creative new age? And what's next?
Well, they missed 2 albums.
They did.
Sure, I must have done more than 3 albums in 5 years. Well, maybe this question's from when I was 68. I don't know. But
is this an AARP question? Yes, this is an AARP question.
Good.
That's what's fueling the question.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Lori, we're going to give you another shot here. What advice about music and or life would today's older and wiser Neil Young give to Neil Young of Buffalo Springfield fame?
I think Buffalo Springfield was younger and wiser. But I think I wouldn't say anything. I would just say, wow, you are in for something. that's going to really blow your mind. You better get, you know, first of all, get a good car. That's very important.
Where is Gary Burden, the great Gary Burden?
Gary Burden.
Yeah,
hey,
Gary.
Sir, how are you?
Okay, Gary. You may even have some Jim James there with you.
Sure.
Yes. Okay, I'm going to read your question, Gary. There was a long gap between when you first started making Human Highway in 1972 and traveled all over the West, including out to Santa Fe and Taos. That was during Dennis Hopper's Off the Deep End period. I remember seeing those amazing images with the Navajo Indians in your first tour bus, Pocahontas. The film didn't get released until 2 years later in 74 when it played in only four cities. Then it was on the shelf until the 21st century when you went back to work on it. There are huge gaps in between when you worked on it, and yet it changed significantly in each of these periods. How in the hell did you keep the story straight in your head through all of this?
Well, it's always scary because I was trying to tell a story, and I knew what the story was, but I could never quite master how to do it because I didn't know anything. And that slowed me down, my lack of experience. But as time went by, I got more experienced. And then I started to use what I'd learned from watching other pictures to just simple, stupid, simple stuff that I had no idea about, like timing.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. Stuff like that, background sounds.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, things that keep the vibe going. You know, they just keep the ambience going. And then once the ambience is consistent, then you kind of relax and start believing this ridiculous
thing
that you're seeing. And you're going, I'm here. Okay. These people are, they're weird, but they're here too, and we're here. You know, it's good. You know, so it's acceptable. And then the timing of things. At one point I thought really slow was really good, and so I loved Godard, and I liked it. Especially, I like to when you're supposed to get a laugh, I like to wait like until there's no way anybody's going to laugh, you know, and there's just wait and wait. But you know, we only had so much film because you run out of film,
right?
So we eventually had to trim it and make it. You know, so that was a real process, man. A growing thing. And when we finally finished the cut, which was Larry Johnson and I and Toshi Inuki, did a cut up at my ranch, my former ranch where I used to live, up north in the Bay Area, we worked on it, and we'd work on it on weekends, you know, and then we'd sit and think about what we did, and then we'd look some more and we'd do it, and we just slowly went through it and tried to bring things together. And instead of breaking things up so much, we let things just kind of play out. Mm-hmm. It's just a lot of stuff that, as a novice, I didn't understand, so I didn't do it right the first time. But I wanted to tell a story of something that was hard to put your finger on, which is, as life goes on, a lot of places things happen, and people are living their lives, and they don't really know what's going on. They're just living their lives and oblivious to everything that's really happening until suddenly one day the bomb drops and it's like, wow, and everybody's gone. But you didn't know. They could have seen it coming if they were listening, but they weren't listening because they were doing other things and they had their own lives. And as ridiculous as the lives were in Linear Valley, they were real to those people. And, you know, the garbage man had their scene going on, and the mechanic had his scene, and the new shop owner had his scene, and the cook and the waitresses had their scenes, and everybody had things they were doing in their lives, and they were all focused on, you know, the talent show was happening, and the guy's going to try to sell the gas station and make a fortune, and everybody's into it, you know. But then the world ended.
Wow. Russ, Charlotte, this is a different way of making movies than you were used to, because you actually have the studio president, financier, star, and director in one body.
Mm-hmm.
Because to go into a room and pitch this idea might have been a good scene for one of your movies.
Oh, pitching that idea?
Yeah. But it works today.
Yeah.
Then might have been rough.
Yeah.
Did it feel like a musical?
Do you think it would work today if I went and tried to do it again? I don't think so. I think if I went and told these people, listen, no script, we're using really good people, and we got a goofy story, and it's I can't tell you what it is because we're making it up as we go along. And we want to build a set. Yeah. And it's going to cost really a lot of money today because everything costs more today than it did then.
Right.
But it's going to look like an old movie that was made a long time ago with all of the same things that were wrong with all the old movies. And except, what's the name of that one? The Gods of Egypt. We didn't want to do that. We wanted to go to somewhere else than that.
You could sell this as a reality show.
Yeah.
Probably it would all work. It would all work.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple quick questions here. Dave from Toronto, I was wondering about that recording of Hey Hey My My with Devo. Is the original studio recording, is that the original studio recording of the song, and did you make any other recordings with Devo?
That's the only one, wasn't it?
That was it.
Yeah, we played it once, didn't we?
We played it once.
Okay. It was good. We're going to zap through a couple of these.
And Bruce Conner directed that.
Yeah, that's right. Bruce Conner was the one. He was in the studio putting that all together and organizing us to do that. And he was a great artist also. And we did it at Different Fur, which was his studio in San Francisco's box.
Who would you like to collaborate with that you haven't yet, and who would you like to work with again?
Wow, that's a good question. Is that the one you warned me about?
No, that's next. Okay. This is from Matt Carroll.
Who would
Matt?
I?
Way to go.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
So who would I like to? Can you read that to me again?
You bet.
Stump the stars.
Matt Carroll asks, who would you like to collaborate with that you haven't yet, and who would you like to work with again?
Well, I'd like to work with just about a lot of people again. I mean, I'd like to do things again, you know, with people that I know. I love working with people that I know. As far as who would I work with that I hadn't worked with yet, I don't think that's one person.
Yeah.
I don't even know who they are. But when I come across them, I will recognize them and want to do it. I mean, I like to do more. I really think that, I'm ready to do more. But I'm going to need a lot more help than I had the first time. If I had to finance everything the first time, and I just couldn't handle it now. So
yeah.
I was peaking at that time. You know, I had a lot of money, and I did a lot of things, and I just did whatever I wanted to do, and I didn't want to ask for permission. And I still don't, but I can't afford to not. Yeah. So it's kind of like I'm in that place. But not for long, I don't think.
So there was a very kind of warm feeling in the green room before we came out here, and it's just kind of wonderful to see the bonds that you form and stay strong through the years. It's great. I went to Neil, and I said, there's a last question I wanted to ask. Do you want me to prepare you for it? And he said, no. I believe in spontaneity, which
kidding.
In itself was a grand answer.
No kidding.
So, no kidding. This is a testament to spontaneity. But this, it's a reference to a Woody Allen movie called Manhattan.
Hold it. I'm thinking now of, you're asking me a question, I'm trying to do the Donald Trump imitation while you're doing it.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. That's good.
So I'm thinking of it. And we were at a party the other night, and I took my hat off, you know, and I have like a huge bald spot now, which is like, but I had a lot of hair. I cut it, most of it off just the other day. But we had a lot, so my lovely girlfriend was making my hair look like Donald Trump as I was being Donald Trump in front of the Republican debate on TV. It was very entertaining, and nobody captured it, thank God.
You know, you say you can't pitch a reality show, but I would tune in to watch that. I would.
Well, Donald Trump ripped off Mussolini.
Okay.
He did.
Yes. All the mannerism.
Well,
also P.T. Barnum.
And P.T. Barnum. Yeah. Well, setting aside Donald for a moment,
all right.
There's a Woody Allen movie called Manhattan, which towards the end, Woody Allen's kind of dictating into a tape recorder the things that make life worth living. And he kind of free associates painting by Cezanne, a certain kind of food, woman's smile. What about you? What are the things that make life worth living?
Love. Number one is love.
Amen.
You can't get farther. If you have got love in your life, then you're that makes life worth living.
Yeah.
and everything else pales in comparison to it. That's the gift of creation. That's the whole thing. That's what makes it go. Nothing compares to love.
Wow.
So, you know, I don't know if that answers the whole question, but it's, that's the way I feel. And I love to see, you know, I love to see people I love, you know, interacting with me and helping me and pointing out things that I've done that are maybe shaky or something, you know, helping me to be a better person and to grow.
Yeah.
You know, so those are the things I really like.
That's amazing. I think, like, in this era where everybody is pushed to become a very knowable quantity, a brand, you know, all of you really can be shown to a young artist as an example of people that didn't go that route. You believed in spontaneity and the path of the artistic journey. And you know, Rust Never Sleeps and Human Highway are grand examples of that. So I want to thank you for the time you've spent here up on the stage answering some of the questions. I think we might have a minute or two left if there's anybody with a question out there. Yes.
I always wondered what you meant in Needle and the Damage Done, Every Junkie's Like a Setting Sun. Both my sons are junkies, and one of them killed himself last year, overdosed at 24 years old, and my older son is struggling with it now. But I played that song since I was 14 years old and just killed my fingers, you know, so I got every note right. But I always wonder what you meant about, you know, every junkie's like a setting sun.
She's asking a question about Needle and the Damage Done and what you meant lyrically.
Yeah, well, I mean, the song's pretty straightforward. And when I said every junkie's like a setting sun, it's like, if that's what you're going to do, you know, you're going to go down. You can't do that. Well, very few people have been able to hold on to that for their whole lives. And their lives have been affected, and even the most successful ones have ended up dying suddenly and ended up not being able to keep it going. So it's such a sad thing. I'm totally feel for you, but it's going to be all right. You know, there's nothing you can do. You're you, and they're them. And that's the thing to remember, is that we're all different, and we're not responsible for the decisions that each other make. We can only try to guide, but we can't take the blame. Mm. No, don't do that.
Last thing, because I think, yes, absolutely. I think we have just a tiny little sliver of a moment left, and I'd just like to say you are off on another creative journey with the promise of the real.
Yeah.
And speaking for those of us who can't wait for more of your stuff with the promise of the real, we love that you have taken this new path and you're out there playing and giving us these wonderful long sets filled with new material that we haven't heard.
Well, thanks. This is, band is a gift. It's a gift. And the whole situation is a gift for me. I'm just very energized to be able to... this band plays more songs than all of my other bands I ever played with combined. They know more of my material. And they really have the... pedigree and the depth and the provenance in their histories to be able to understand what it is I'm doing and why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And so it's effortless. It's completely effortless. It's like nothing else I've experienced, and I don't want to compare it to anything else I've done, and that's not what I'm doing. But it is unique. And I'm just finishing the second album with them right now.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. So looking forward with these great artists, we're going to thank Jerry and Charlotte and Russ and Neil, and take a little look back into the not so distant past for Russ Never Sleeps Now.
All right.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, guys.